That's right. Today on Music, Mindfulness, and Madness, we're talking about the one, the only, Adam Ant. And one of the great things about Adam Ant is how many of his songs...
Xerox machine!
How many of his songs have just phenomenal intros. You know, we could do this all day long.
That's true. I never thought about that. That's very true. Car trouble. Oh, yeah. We could just spend the entire... Yeah, and music. We could spend the entire episode if you could just like play like the first 2 seconds. Like, guess that Adam Ant song.
Sure. Name that Ant tune. Name that Ant music.
I would like to do that.
I mean, you know, everybody's got some hits and misses.
Put some wax on the tracks and slide on out of here.
Hein. Buttons and bows and blue block rouge. All things lively must be used. Legal tea, egality, all she vol phone, twit. La 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 in Croya. Well, I got the moose. You got Anna's got the cruise. Some of the gods and they all approve. Okay,
sorry. So Dee, I think you were the one who put this topic on the board. What were you thinking?
I thought you did. Did I? No, I think you mentioned it. If I did, I think you mentioned it, and then I put the card up, and then...
It might have been when... I don't even know how it got on here. Maybe it was when we were talking
about... I was just so excited that someone besides me was a rabid Adam Ant fan, I think.
Maybe it was when we were talking about the Slits and the Beatles and stuff, and it was like, oh, you know, we should talk about Adam Ant, because he was around during that, you know, same classic early British time, and... In some ways, you could argue he is one of the ideal people for us to talk about on a podcast called Music, Mindfulness, and Madness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He's a very good character study.
Yeah, and a gentleman too. All the footage I've been watching and sort of how he addressed, you know, controversies that came up for him, especially like the face paint and indigenous, you know, appropriation. He did some amazing, he addressed it directly and with the people that were, you know, offended by him. And then they gave him a pass. They were just like, you know what? This guy's for real. He's doing it with, you know, true spirit of where we come from and our heritage. And I believe he comes from some indigenous folks as well. And I was like, wow, this guy's, you know, because
he was broaching topics of inclusivity 40 years before that was a term in the zeitgeist, really, you know?
Yeah. He said, you know, he also said in an interview, he said, today might be if it was happening today from the start, now it might be a different story. But he said back then, you know, it was like, even then it was really like, you know, a lot of artists would have just gone, oh, whatever. But he really addressed that stuff directly. And I thought it spoke to his character. And because really all I know about him is the music and very, all I know is from the fluff of like radio and MTV. And like, I wasn't a study of him, you know, you guys were really deep into the Adam Ant and I'm just,
oh no, like Jonesy, he had a pretty fucked up life.
Yeah.
Pretty fucked up childhood.
So where do we start?
Why don't we start at the top? It's worth noting that basically in 1983, 1984, Adam Ant was the biggest pop music star in the UK. The biggest. He was bigger than Michael Jackson.
He was like the Michael Jackson of the UK.
He was bigger than Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And it had taken him, you know, 5 years to get there. And he had held that top spot for a little while, and then started a slide into problems that, like many of these things, as they say, happened slowly and then all at once. There's a good ending to the story, but let's start there. You know, in 83 is I guess sort of when I think of his. being on top of the world. He was rolling out single after single that was blown up in number one on the charts in the UK, displacing everybody else. He was touring the United States. He had made a bunch of videos that were on MTV. And in a lot of ways, he was ideal for MTV, because here's this guy who definitely doesn't look like anybody else in any respect and going all the way with it. He had this Native American or indigenous people derived face paint and this kind of colonial jacket and outfits and big dance moves. And he also wrote a pile of real hooky songs and did very, very well. But the public doesn't stick with the same thing forever, the same flavor forever. And while he was massively successful in the UK, he did not have quite that same level of success in the United States, where mostly people who aren't, you know, 80s music fans think of him as the guy who did Goody Two Shoes. You know, there might be one or two other songs that kind of got some notice for him, but that's probably the biggest of his hits here in the USA.
Yeah, it's really too bad too, because he had, I mean, the work that he did, that for my money, my favorite work of his is everything up to Kings of the Wild Frontier, and then maybe Kings of the Wild Frontier. But like everything before that is hands down my favorite of stuff. And Dirk wears White Socks is not at all. It's an Adam and the Ants record, but it's nothing like the stuff that would come.
Yeah, well, he started off as a punk, right? Straight out of the punk scene, knowing a lot of those same people that we've talked about. And
he's another Zelig type, right? Like he, so there's a bit of an intersect that happens between this episode and the Jonesy Pistol episode, in that there is a scene in Pistol where they go play their first show, and Jonesy's talking about how he needs to get a Marshall half stack. So he talks Paul into stealing one with him. They show up with it, and they don't really get into, you know, like a lot of the details in Pistol, they don't call this out, and they don't invoke names. But the band that he's about to get in a fight with is a band called in real life is a band called Bazooka Joe. That was Adam Ant's first band.
Huh.
So the guy that he's facing down with, that the character is Adam Ant. It's the guy that he sees, you know, the guy that's telling him you can't use that amp. I mean, I you know, who knows if that actually happened? I mean, again, it's a Danny Boyle movie, and they fudge in the details. But that was Adam Ant's first band. So and that was like 75. So again, like Chrissy Hynde, like we were talking about Chrissy Hynde, a bit of a Zelig character, like just was everywhere. Was one of those guys who was right there at the beginning and kind of hovered under the success of the Pistols and the Clash and all those other bands for a long time, and then Kings of the Wild Frontier happened.
Yeah, and also, you know, Malcolm was also, you know, hugely influential and a good friend of Adam's as well. And
he's until he totally screwed him over, as Malcolm screws everybody over.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, the whole Burundi beat, I mean, all that came from Malcolm. I mean, you know.
That was Malcolm.
Yep. It'd be questionable, you know, like, who would Adam Ant be without that? I mean, he was like, he definitely had all the makings of a star and was like bringing himself to bear. But that particular beat and the production and all that, and we could talk about production later too, but just as an icon, you know, just because I wasn't really a close study on the guy, but I really loved everything I heard. It was always just like one of a kind signature. You knew it when his song came on, any of his songs. And as I was listening, my girlfriend was reading this article to me about, you know, the amount of hits that he had off of each album was just, one of them had like 12 or 13 hits. Like each one of them was like a number one single in England. And I was like, holy crap. Like, who else has done that here? And then there's a story about Michael Jackson calling him and asking him about where he got his jacket and all that. And,
oh, and how he got some particular sounds, and then never calling him back again. He, you know,
yeah,
Michael Jackson got what he needed and then left him, as he will do.
Boom. Yeah, super fascinating. So when did you guys first kind of come into the Adamant world? Like, what was your first reckoning of like, what is this, you know? And then finding out about Adamant. That's what I want to know.
Well, so I've talked about this a few times before. I really lucked out with the first punk band I was in with the cousins, Tony Slug and Dave Dirt. The two of them had incredible record collections. I think I am pretty sure that between them, they had the Xerox single, the first thing that he did. And then Tony had this Chelsea Girl single. He had a bunch of the singles that Adam and the Ants had done very early on. So I got to hear that stuff. Wasn't really that, I mean, it wasn't, it's kind of like what the story I talk about with the power pop bands my friend Tony Slug shared with me. At the time, I was all about Black Flag and the Circle Jerks and the Adolescents. And when he was playing me this stuff, I was like, well, what the fuck is this? Take this off. I didn't really think much of it.
D.
Yeah. And then I think not too long. I mean, Kings of the Wild Frontier came out in 80. So not too long after that, Kings of the Wild Frontier came out. And then I think from there, was totally blown away by that album. Went back and found Dirk Wears White Socks after that. Really, really liked that a lot. That and like the Car Trouble EP. All of the stuff that was kind of leading up to Kings of the Wild Frontier was all stuff I became obsessed with straight away. So backing up a little bit more, if we can jump around, Adamant was born to two parents. Dad skipped out at a very young age. When he got into art school, he started playing in this band, Bazooka Joe, and that kind of disintegrated. And after that disintegrated, he became interested in ants. He had this obsession with ants and then started a band called The Ants. It wasn't Adam and the Ants initially. That band, there's a British punk rock movie from 78 called Jubilee. That version of the band is in. And I think that lineup actually even predates the Bow Wow Wow guys. Like that's a lineup that didn't really, that didn't have any of the Bow Wow Wow guys in it yet. So he does that, drops a couple singles. I think he drops Chelsea Girls, drops Xerox, and then assembles the band somewhere in there that would become the lineup, the Bow Wow Wow lineup, the classic Bow Wow Wow lineup that played on Dirk Wears White Socks. Didn't have a lot of success with Dirk Wears White Socks. and then around that time does all the things that you guys were talking about with Malcolm. Malcolm has the discovers this Burundi music and talks to Adam about this idea of doing something based on the Burundi beat. I think Adam was the one that landed on the idea of doing this sort of pirate theme, mixing the pirate theme with the Burundi beat.
Yeah.
As far as the look. It's not really clear what happened. And, you know, like rewatching the madness of Prince Charming doesn't really reveal it either. Malcolm McLaren said it and he talks about it. He goes, he basically says, yeah, I know that I look like an asshole. I really don't care that I was made out to be the asshole throughout this. Quite frankly, I consider it I consider it high praise that people think I'm an asshole for doing what I did. But it's not really clear what happened. So, but the short of it is something happened. Malcolm extracted all of the ants from that band and started Bow Wow Wow, like Anu was talking about a while back with Annabella the Wind. The thing that's interesting is, you know, it was only a year prior to all this crazy success that he had you know, where he became bigger than Michael Jackson and all of those things, he was without a band. He was robbed of his band, was back to square one, no management, nothing. Finds a Marco Peroni, hooks up with Marco Peroni, and then they put another band together, and they go out and do Kings of the Wild Frontier.
Yeah, it was one of the articles that came up too was about with his producer, well, one of the producers, Chris Merrick Hughes, who became a drummer in the sort of the second version of the Ants and really helped to develop that sort of the sound and the production, and then was in the band and performing with them for a year and a half or two, something like that. And so reading that article was really interesting as well. I'm just like, ah, because I'm always, you know, we're such like production nerds and like,
oh yeah,
how do they get the sounds? And like, you know, he was like, really, he got it as a drummer as well as a producer. And I was like, cause the layers of sound between the guitars, everything I listened to was really like, there's these layers of drums and layers of guitars. And this is back when, you know, recording gear was much more crude than it is today. And like, you know,
and all the vocal stacking that Adam Ant would do too. Like he would do insane vocal stacking on those records.
So much, you know, that like, you know, heave ho kind of like pirate, you know, shout and all that stuff and the drums and the guitars. And I was really, I don't know, I was just taken by the guitar work and the drumming and all that. And his voice is so signature too, that sort of like yelpy, sort of like poppy. That
yelpy tenor.
Yeah, good looking guy. Distinctive. Throw him up on the screen, the girls go crazy, and he said it was bonkers. He said it was nuts, it was great, but it also, you know, when it goes away so quickly, that's you know the drop. But
yeah, so he was diagnosed bipolar at a pretty young age, like before, like early on when Adam and the Ants were a thing, like right around the time that the big pop lineup was put together, he was diagnosed bipolar. And I guess he managed to kind of hold it together throughout those first few years where they enjoyed a lot of success. But then, like, you know, like Anna was saying, like as he got into the late 80s, early 90s, the bipolar aspect of his personality started to rear its ugly head and kind of took over. But, you know, the thing that's interesting, Michael, from a music production perspective, is what he did with the whole Burundi beat vibe and what Malcolm McLaren did. I'm ascribing credit to Malcolm McLaren, what Bow Wow Wow did with it. Bow Wow Wow's take on the Burundi thing, I think, was like, to me, having heard all the Burundi beat stuff, is much closer in form to Burundi music. Like if you think about like what Bow Wow's guitar player was doing with the guitar work, it's very African in feel. It's almost like he's almost doing like Fela Kuti type stuff at times.
Yeah, that West African guitar work is amazing. Just kind of incredible, all that stuff. And I know, like Anu's brother really loves that stuff too. I remember talking to him about that.
Yeah,
sort of West African guitar work, and I was just. Yeah, listening to it.
Conversely, like if you look like you go back and listen to the Kings of the Wild Frontier or Prince Charming, what he's doing with it is it's almost just another he's just kind of borrowing from it as part of the melting pot. Really. It's not as African the way he did it. Like he's doing the beats for things like Ant Music and Stand and Deliver and all that stuff the same way. But he's got this, like you said, Michael, like he's got Marco Peroni who's playing those big rock guitars and stuff. And a lot of what they do, I've noticed, I had this epiphany some years later after watching, the Glitter Band. So after Gary Glitter left, the band that was Gary Glitter, the guys from that band stayed together, and they had a band called the Glitter Band. And boy, and this is, you know, this is like early 70s, 73, 74. That stuff sounds like what would become Kings of the Wild Frontier. So there's like a heavier glam, like Gary Glitter, Roxy Music kind of glam vibe to the Adam Ant Burundi thing. I don't want to say stark contrast. It's quite a bit different from what Bow Wow Wow ended up doing, you know?
Yeah. And I loved all the sort of spaghetti Western stuff that Peroni got into.
Just
the endless kind of guitar riffs and like the kind of darker sort of harmonic transitions too, you know, that were surprising, but like really worked. I was just curious as, you know, why do you think Adam Ant was such a huge success in terms of like such an unusual sound? I mean, was it because of the unusual sound other than just his, you know, star quality that he's got?
I want to hear what Anu thinks because he's been quiet.
Well, there's a bunch of aspects of this that we should take in. First of all, I think we should we'll play a couple of clips of the Burundi beat and how it was interpreted. So this beat was found by the West in the early 70s when some recordings of it started making their way from Africa back out to the UK. And there was a guy who basically took a field recording of the beat and put some kind of lame keyboards and stuff underneath it, called it Burundi Black, and got a lot of airplay with it. For our non-musical listeners, one of the things that's worth noting is that for the most part, all rock music tends to have a very similar beat structure, a backbeat, where there's a snare on 2 and 4 and a kick drum on usually on 1 and some of the other beats.
So very good call out on it.
The idea that someone could have discovered a new beat is a little bit like someone saying, I have found a new color. So one of the things that immediately got people's attention was the fact that this beat exists, and it very quickly got picked up by a whole bunch of people. Aside from this kind of novelty hit of Burundi Black, one of the first things that I can think of that really picked it up was Joni Mitchell, who used it on The Hissing of Summer Lawns in a song called The Jungle Line. So here's here's a little bit of that.
There it is. Wow.
So it's basically like this.
Interesting.
That's more or less the Burundi beat as it was picked up and interpreted by the West. And you'll notice right away, it's very different from the boom, bap, boom, boom, bap. It's got this kind of decaying thing where there's a lot of notes up front and a little pause at the end, right? And you can hear that very clearly in what Joni Mitchell was doing on Hissing of Summer Lawns, which I think is like 1976, right?
Wow. So it's
already a few years after that, and the whole track.
I didn't know anything about any of this.
Yeah, that song, The Jungle Line, the whole track is built on top of that. It was a very influential track. Thomas Dolby says that was the song that made him want to get into electronic music. She's doing a sort of a typical thing at the time of like using this perceived to be old and exotic African rhythm to talk about modern times of 1976. And here's an example of what Adam and the Ants would have done with that same beat. So this is from Kings of the Wild.
We are the family.
I'll skip ahead.
A new royal family. Why no?
So you can hear that same beat, and they're playing with it a little bit, right? They're adding some variations, but it's that same. And they had originally thought that like, hey, we've discovered this new color, so we can build our entire sound around this new beat. You know, instead of everything being backbeat based, we'll build it off of that. Well, most of us know that building your entire sound off of a single motif or thing like that is going to be pretty limiting. And that said, the other problem was that around this time, as we noted, Adam Ant, Stuart Goddard, this is his real name, had started off as a punk. And he had already put this record out, Dirk Wears White Socks, and it didn't do anything, as Dee noted. And basically it was, just kind of sort of punk rock, but Adam already had different ambitions.
It was like his Man Who Sold the World.
Yeah.
You know,
Malcolm McLaren.
Really good record that nobody heard.
Malcolm McLaren comes along, he hears this Burundi beat thing that they're starting to experiment with, and he basically decides that what he needs to do is to steal Adam Ant's band and put a teenage singer in front of it so that he can sell clothes or do whatever he wants. And so here is Bow Wow Wow, Bow Wow Wow's version of the Burundi beat from a song called C30, C60, C90 Go. Here it is. So you can hear they've basically sped it up. It's that same beat. They've sped it up, given it some punkier energy. And this resulted in basically Adam Ant desperately trying to pull a new band together. So he grabs this guy, Marco Peroni, who at the time had played guitar in another band called Susie and the Banshees. He grabs another guy named...
Little band. Before that, played it in another little band called The Flowers of Romance.
With Sid Viv and, Albertine kind of, and Sid Albertine. Vicious, right?
Yep. Also a big fixture in the scene.
Yeah. Further evidence of the kind of interconnectedness of that scene at that time. And they pick up one of the drummers that they pick up is a guy who goes by the name of Merrick, who is also known as Chris Hughes. And aside from being a drummer, he became a producer and would go on to produce records like Songs from the Big Chair by Tears for Fears and a bunch of other smash.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
Really?
Same guy.
Wow.
Same guy.
Same time, too.
So
same
time. Adam and Malcolm have a little bit of a falling out, but as you can read on Wikipedia and elsewhere, basically Malcolm says to Adam, well, what do you want? And Adam Ant says, look, I want to sell millions of records. And Malcolm says, well, you're doing it wrong. Like this, this Dirk Wears White Sox stuff is not going to make it. And if you want to be a big hit pop star, you need to think about things in a very different way. And that was a life-changing and course-changing experience for Adam Ant. He had this fresh start and basically reinvented himself as someone who was going to be a pop star. He didn't just want to smash everything to the ground. He wanted to be big and dove into trying to be big in every way he possibly could. He got this new look with the very flamboyant and unusual costumes, started trying to write big hit songs or at least things that were going to be compelling, and went after stuff in a really a very different way than he had been doing before. And there is something about that that I think is incredibly brave. Now, Michael, you'd asked how I heard about Adam Ant. I think probably like most Americans out on the East Coast, I probably heard of him initially when Friend or Foe came out and Goody Two Shoes was one of the singles from that record. That's the sort of one hit wonder song, but I was always partial to Desperate But Not Serious, which was the other single from that record.
Yeah, that was huge.
I think that song is great because it's got all of the elements that I like in pop music, but also really captures a lot of what makes Adam Ant work. So it's a little bit silly and a little bit punny. The title basically tells you everything you need to know. It's like, well, who is this guy? Well, he's desperate, but he's not serious. That's being a teenager, I think, in a lot of ways. It had a great horn section. It had a kind of twangy, tremolo-y James Bond guitar, and a little bit of a minor key darkness, in the verses, but big hits. Nice horn section coming in, easy to sing along with, etc. So that was how I found out about him. And then, as was the case back in those days, I started moving backwards to learn more and more about his wilder, crazier, punkier things, where he was more of a pirate or, smashing through windows in videos and being the dandy highwayman, etc. And right after that, he released Strip, I think, in 1983 or 84. That was kind of the peak of his success in the United States. The first sort of real girlfriend I had at the time, I won't name her name. I doubt she's listening, but if she is, she knows who she is.
I'm gonna name her name.
She was head over heels for Adam Ant, and she just thought he was like the sexiest, coolest thing and could not get enough of him singing Strip. And I'm sort of looking at Adam Ant and I'm like, this guy? Like, he's kind of scrawny. His hairline's receding. He looks a little nuts. He is hardly like suave and debonair and sexy or dangerous in a cool way, the way that, you know, most of the other pop stars I was looking at were. He seemed just sort of sketchy, I guess. But, you know, people seemed to like him, and he had a pretty big hit with that. And then after that, it kind of went off the rails for him a little bit. His next couple records didn't do so good. I think he had Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis produce one.
Yeah, he did. Yes. Oh, weird. Yeah, that's right. He did.
Yeah. And, but you know, basically by the end of the 80s, he was out of the picture and sort of considered like a has been, like a lot of
those. Did some acting too. He did some acting. He did some acting in
Equalizer, a show.
Equalizer.
Did some, so back in the early 80s when he was blown up, sort of like Phil Collins talks about in his autobiography, he was just doing everything he could. He was releasing an album every year. He was touring the world. He was making a pile of videos. He was working on costumes. And I think one downside to having that kind of massive success is that you're going to burn people out on whatever you do. Particularly if you have a strong visual and musical identity like he did, it turns into, I don't know if I'd say a gimmick, but it's kind of like people start paying attention to the costume and the sound, and then they're expecting you to blow their minds with something that is kind of the same but different over and over again. And it's really hard. And if you've gone from hard scrabble, nothing upbringings to massive success because you've been working your ass off for 5 years, you get to a point where you're like, I don't know what to do anymore, and I'm tired, and I can't do it. And he had, like,
and I've got bipolar disorder, and my bipolar disorder is growing increasingly unmanageable.
Yeah, and suffering knee injuries from aggressive dancing and just wearing himself out. And so basically, you know, he was kind of out of the picture by the end of the 80s. But for the beginning, you know, he describes the big breakthrough was when they played Dog Eat Dog on Top of the Pops. And he said,
it was,
we went on Top of the Pops for 3 minutes. We played Dog Eat Dog. That was it. And the next day, 200,000 people went out and bought the record.
It's fucking insane.
And he
was
said
like that, overnight. It was literally, it was a textbook overnight success.
Yeah. Well, especially since, in his own words, that 3.5 minutes took 3.5 years to prepare for. He was also, he's not just cold and calculating. He was a really kind and sentimental man in some ways. There was this art teacher from school that had always been supportive of his artistic tendencies when he was a kid and nobody else was. And he sent her copies of every record he ever made.
That's pretty
cool. I think I think she might be the person that gets interviewed in this, the Madness of Prince Charming thing.
He was the most written about celebrity in the UK in 1981, except for Princess Diana. So
wow. Yeah, it was nuts.
Of all of that. And, for me, the arc is pretty straightforward. It's like, here's this hungry young kid, very creative, coming up with a sound, enduring some setbacks in a rapid climb to mega stardom, right? 81 to 83 or 84, 80 to 84, whatever. Every wish he had came true. He was doing everything. And then within a few years, it was basically all over. And a long, slow reckoning and dealing with mental and physical problems and et cetera. The story ends well. We'll get to that at some point. But I think there is something about this adapting and surviving that is part of the Adam Ant mythology. And I think it's part of what makes him compelling to me as a person. As an artist, the one thing we should probably also talk about is, I think ultimately, first of all, you know, he writes catchy songs. They're weird, but they're not Scott Walker weird. They're just unusual, but they always have big hooks. They're well-structured. He played a lot of uncredited bass on those songs. He is a more talented musician than people might give him credit for.
He is. Yep.
You know, so there's that aspect to what he's doing. Very talented and creative guy. What do you guys think about all that?
God, I had a thought and now it escaped me. I was going to say, so it's, you know, the thing, the thing about the doggy dog appearance, it was, you know, it was 1980, and it was like a perfect storm of events that allowed that thing to blow up. If you go, you can anybody can go back on YouTube and find old episodes of Top of the Pops. It's, you know, as a kid, I would read all, you know, the ID magazines and all the British magazines, you know, to learn about what Adam was up to and all the other bands that were big at the time. And they all talk about being on Top of the Pops, and they would slag, you know, what Top of the Pops was normally like. You don't really have context. I didn't as a kid, just listening to them talk about what Top of the Pops was like until you see Top of the Pops. I would encourage everybody to just go out and like watch some random episode on YouTube of Top of the Pops from like 1978 or 1977. And it'll give you a pretty clear picture of what the world was like in the UK and what Top of the Pops was like at the time. Adam Ant came on stage in a bunch of pirate, you know, with a bunch of dudes in pirate clothes, playing this Burundi beat thing and singing about and singing Doggy Dog. You can't underscore how impactful that was, because he just arrived out of thin air in a way at the time. And so that happened, and much the way things went with Top of the Pops, if you came up in the UK and you had a band in the UK pre-MTV, that they all say this, that, you know, the only way that you could really break out as a pop stars was to get a slot on Top of the Pops. That's just how it worked. If you wanted to be a big pop star, you had to play your song on Top of the Pops, because that's the only place that people would go to watch music. He does this in 1980. Now MTV launches less than a year later, 1981. And the next thing he does is makes a music video for, so he had the Doggy Dog thing with the appearance on Top of the Pops, and MTV started playing that, but then he did a video for Ant Music, and that's the thing that really connected with people in the States once that happened. So it was like perfect timing, right? He did this crazy fucking thing that no one had ever seen before in 1980, and then months later MTV starts, and he hops on the music. He's one of those early adopters of the whole music video format. And that really just propels him to another level.
You know, it almost seems like, I mean, Top of the Pops, probably the equivalent, you know, kind of like Dick Clark here or Soul Train. Like if you want to get exposure, because I remember seeing the Blasters on, you know, Dick Clark. And it was like, you know, what was his show? It was the American Bandstand. You're like, and I'm watching, I'm like, the Blasters, this is amazing. You know, this like little band from Southern California, and they're playing this sort of like, you know, roots American music. And so I imagine like, but over there, and I got to imagine it was pretty well structured, kind of like Top of the Pops, where it's like, or the BBC, any of that stuff where they're like, here's what we're going to give you this opportunity, but you have to fit into this little.
Very, very. You know what it's more like, Michael? Do you remember that show Solid Gold?
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Sure. Top of the Pops is Solid Gold is totally American Top of the Pops, like in terms of structure.
But it's also worth noting that the dancers, all that shit. Top of the Pops was also way bigger in the UK because there were fewer options. Huge.
That's all there was.
Prime time. So, you know, if you got on there, it was going to be a big deal. And quite a win for Adam. And then of course, he killed it, you know, blew everybody away. And you can even see in the YouTube comments, because we'll put it up in the links afterwards, but I found a version of this, and everyone's just like, I saw this and it blew my mind. I saw this and I went to the record store the next day and bought the record.
Yeah.
You know, I can't think of anything like that happening anymore. Granted, this was, you know, 42 years ago. But, you know, it was one of those things that, like, as you go back and start discovering this stuff, you realize that there's a bunch of great songs. There's some really interesting things. Some of it, because of the clever guitar playing from Marco, But the thing that really, that ultimately I really took away from Adamant when I rediscovered him in the mid 90s is his absolute commitment to what he is doing. Right.
Oh, yeah.
He is not winking at the camera in a, like, I know I'm ridiculous kind of a way. It, like a great actor or a comedian or whatever, he sort of commits to the bit.
You know? Oh, he's selling it. He is fucking selling it.
Whatever he's singing about, he's going out there and he is going, you know, 110%. And I think that is part of what makes him compelling, sexy, whatever. It's that, like, he is giving all of himself to whatever it is he's doing, whatever that message or thing might be. That's the thing I think that comes across. And it's an important lesson for any performer. It's like, you can't hold back. You can't be kind of halfway doing it and kind of, you know, being arch or sarcastic or whatever. It's like the audience can detect that and they don't like it. But they love it when you are all the way in. And he definitely was.
Yeah, I remember in one of the articles I read, he was talking about, well, that was read to me. I was driving at the time. So my girl was talking about he really took on characters, much like David Bowie or Madonna or any of that. He really, like, took on the character, and he said, and it changed over time. And he talked about sort of like the gimmickiness. He said, people can only take that for so long. So you really have to sort of, you know, bring what worked about the last character into what's next, like whatever those performance elements are. And I really like that, because I was sort of thinking about that for my own music. And I'm like, you know, what character am I? Because we talked about, you know, grumpy.
Oh, I can tell you what character you are.
Yeah, I'll bet you can. I'm going to come up there and you know what? But that it was like the, like, grumpy keyboard and guitar players. And it's like, you know, what character am I playing? Because I really, you know, if you want to think about it as an artist, you're like, oh, I'm just being myself. But it's like all the greats, you know, the Bowies and the Adamants and all that, they always took on a character as a mask, kind of what Anu had spoken to before. And what I've seen you guys do individually, too, is like you can take on a sort of a persona and a character, and then you sort of fill that in. Like a painting almost. And I really liked that idea a lot. So that was very inspiring to, again, discover another, you know, artist that was probably dismissed or underrated, even though he sold so many records. He had, I forget, like dozens and dozens of singles off of, like, sometimes whole records. It seems like everything was like a successful single in the UK. And over here, he was like, oh, who's that pirate guy? And all the girls... Anu's girlfriend goes like, oh my God, he's so sexy. And it's like every girl thought he was like amazing. And I'm just like,
well, yeah, that, I mean, like, you know, there was a time that Ant music video was getting played 50 times a day.
Yeah.
Stand and Deliver, like all that shit. The MTV was playing the shit out of that stuff.
I think Stand and Deliver was the main first song I think I probably ever heard. It was probably on K-Rock here in Southern California. And definitely MTV. I remember the first day of MTV, I stumbled upon MTV. And I don't really, maybe that's another episode too about that whole channel. But that was really mind-boggling for me, because I just was like, turned the TV on. I'm like, what is this? And there's that, the theme song comes on, and then all these videos, and then Adam Ant, and like... That's going to be our new theme song there.
Yeah.
Aberration. Anyway, yeah, so it was really, and I'm always just fascinated by people like Anu, what you were saying, he really gave it 110%. Like, you believe the guy, because every time I see people sing or play, I mean, you either believe them or you don't. And I think it's instinctual, because, you know, there's this new band that I've been sort of just starting to follow, and I'm not going to speak too much about them because I want to discover more, but I saw this little clip and I was like, oh, wow, I believe that shit. And it sounded great and it's not for everybody, but I was like, yeah, I believe that. And you Adam know, he, definitely that, you know.
He Stuart, a.k.a. Adam, Stuart Goddard, he, like a lot of these guys at the time, he was an art student. He went to art school. He was working full time as a graphic designer around the time Adam and the Ants started to blow up. So he's got a background in graphic design, and he was another one of those guys, like all the guys from Bauhaus that went to art school, and has that I don't know if it can be completely ascribed to it, but this, it just seems like there must have been a really good fucking art school program in the UK at the time, because a lot of these guys that came out of, I don't, you know, because they all have that same kind of, like, Adam came up with this whole idea for pirate clothes, and if you read interviews with him at the time, he could talk your ear off about context and about how he came up with these things and how he can connect the dots from the band jacket he's wearing to things that are going on now. Like he understood art and how art could influence and impact people in a way that, I mean, I never did, you know? And you can see it. You can see it with what he did in the Kings of the Wild Frontier period, in the Prince Charming period. Prince Charming period was kind of weird in a way. Like he took the whole thing to the next level, but like Anu said, the guy could fucking sell it. He could sell it in a way that still made it relevant, you know?
Well, I think the authenticity part of it, kind of what Anu was pointing to as well, both of you are pointing to, is that and the article that you know came up yesterday was really about his research. I mean, he was really well informed, well read, smart, charming, but also like could tie it all together. And I've heard you do a lot of this D too, you know, where you're like, there's certain art pieces, like you have concepts and you tie all that stuff in. And I think it's very powerful to create sort of that fabric of whatever the project is you're working on. Some people do it better than others. And like really all the sort of the zeitgeist point where like everything came to fruition, like, you know, what he was bringing to the scene, the cultural stuff going on in England at the time, which we talked about with Pistol and like all the punk scene, which was a bunch of artists and a whole bunch of creatives and like clothing designers, and everything was kind of you can call it a revolution. I mean, the only people that died really probably were the junkies, you know, or people that, you know, were beaten down by the police. But, you know, when you have an individual who's so well-informed and really committed and like desperate, but clearly more, you know, he was definitely serious because he kept at it forever and he's still doing it. I mean, I saw him, what was it, 4 years ago? He was amazing. Yep. It was amazing. I mean, was it?
Oh, you saw that tour?
Yeah. Like, was he what he was back then? I mean, there was a few parts where I'm like, okay, all right, you know, kind of age appropriate, but like he sold it. He was amazing and everyone went nuts. People, he's like that kind of guy where you're rabid for him, kind of like the Michael Jackson thing where people are just, even with all the bad press and stuff, they're just like undeniable. Oh, and I like too, he told a story that, you know, Michael Jackson called him, but also he called him three times. He called him twice. And then Quincy Jones actually called and said, look, Adam, this is Quincy Jones. I'm with Michael Jackson. And it's like, this is real. Cause he thought it was his drummer or something. And he was going to, he's like,
he thought it was a goof. Like he was fucking with him.
Yeah. He's like, you know, fuck off. I'm going to come thump you if you continue to call me. And then, you know, Quincy Jones calls and he's like, oh, sorry, mate. You know, I thought it was, you know, you were having a piss at me. And it was really funny, but you know, that sort of star quality and that commitment, that's that magic I think kind of everyone's seeking outside of themselves. And like when an artist can find that inside themselves and how tenuous it is and how fleeting that sort of, you know, fame and fortune and all that. And, you know, the, you know, mental illness and whatnot. And I really appreciate how graceful he's been with it. And he's kind of become, well, what he said was the kind of the face of bipolar and talking about it and mental illness and like how when you can get, you know, the medicine right and the treatment of it, it's a very powerful tool. Because a lot of the people that I know that are you know, on the spectrum and sort of like in a more obvious way, they have some powerful insight and creative wells that are just amazing, you know? So it's, if you can harness it, I think it's an incredible gift. But, you know, when it goes bad, it's like, oof, man, humanity just kind of, it's hard. So I really appreciate how he handled all that and just continues to forge forth. I mean, you know, he's committed. He just loves
bipolar disorder is no fucking joke. If you're out on the end of the spectrum, he's on, no fucking joke, man.
Yeah, it was. It's hard, you know. And it's. I'm glad it's more in the consciousness, and people are talking about it in a way where it's like, oh, this is treatable. I mean, look at our vets in the country. I don't want to get all political about it, but there's a lot of people who are struggling with like PTSD and bipolar and all that. And I think, you know, having a platform for that, you know, especially with someone who's, you know, that visible and can talk about it and then continue to like live a fantastic life. That's awesome.
I think something that happens a lot with perhaps artists or creative people in particular, but maybe more people in general, which is that as long as whatever illness you're dealing with is distorting your thinking in ways that are productive or helpful or financially rewarding for somebody else, everybody's fine with it. And you could look at how hard Adam Ant was working in his early years and the desperate circumstances he was coming from and start to say, oh yeah, well, clearly maybe there's a little mania going on here, you know, et cetera. But everyone's like, hey, it's fine. The guy's cranking stuff out and he's doing great and he's working hard and we're all making money and fantastic. And then when sort of the bill comes due, you know, I remember reading about when he was having problems in the late 80s and early 90s, and it was just sad. And it was just sort of like, here's this old has-been who's a kook now, ha ha ha. And it was quite heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But you can think about any number of other artists that we talked about. I mean, geez, you could look at Kanye West, for example. You know, another...
You could.
Another artist who had a strong early career and now appears to be dealing with serious mental problems.
Yeah.
You know, in Adam Ant's case, he did get some help eventually. You know, it took a long
time. Spent some time at a hospital too.
Yeah.
Actually. He spent some time inpatient at a hospital.
To get back to some place that's at least for him normal. And I'm glad that he continues to have a career. He put out a new album a couple years ago and he has been doing this kind of legacy tour for a while. COVID interrupted it. I saw him when he first got back together and came rolling through San Francisco and, you know, he's doing great. It's I would have music directed the show a little differently and made some different choices, but he played all the hits and he sounded great. Yeah. And had two drummers and, you know, rocked out. And he's one of these guys that I think everyone forgets how influential he was. Like as some more examples, the reason that Michael Jackson wore all those military jackets is because he saw Adam Ant.
Shut up.
It's true.
No, for real.
That's why. Shut Michael, up.
It's for Michael real true. Him. In fact, Michael Jackson, one of the reasons he was called,
he called up
Adam Ant for a couple of reasons. One is that he wanted to know how he got all the crazy drum sounds for like the Burundi beat with all of the stuff being banged on. And Adam Ant was just like, we just banged on like road cases and a bunch of stuff. And yeah, both Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones were disappointed that there wasn't some more of a trick to it. But Michael Jackson was also really interested in like the vintage jacket. Military jacket that he was wearing and basically stole that look from Adam Ant.
Much like Michael Jackson did with a lot of things.
Yes. And Trent Reznor has been very vocal that the backwards N in the Nine Inch Nails logo is ripped straight off from the backwards D in Adam and the Ants.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I knew he was a fan. Physical. And he did that great version of Physical.
And that was the other thing I was going to say is on his big breakthrough record, the Broken EP, there is a secret cover of You're So Physical by Adam Ant.
I saw him perform that the first time I saw them play.
Yeah. And it's not one of these like, ha ha ha, ironic.
It's pretty fucking epic.
80s things. He's like, this is a great intense song.
Yeah. Yeah. He treated it for what it was. It was just a great fucking song.
Yeah. So there's just like, you know, the fabric of all the stuff that we listen to. I mean, you know, it seems like every episode we're talking about this, like even, you know, the pistol, that whole thing and like all the fabric of it. And like, as we talk about this stuff, I really love this a lot because I get to discover this as well. Cause like, I'm no Adam Ant expert, but like just what little research I did, you know, and sort of the fabric of sort of Southern California music, like coming through K-Rock down here, which was hugely influential nationally, and probably internationally, you know, because everyone was like, oh, K-Rock is like, because they were so huge, you know, Adam Ant was like pushing through that like all the time. In my little 80s, you know, high school years, it was just like, you know, struggling to find sort of an image. And like, there's these people like Adam Ant that comes up and they're like, they push through that stuff for themselves and find a way, you know, or Pistol or, you know, the Pistols or any of that stuff. It's really like a case study and like, this is what it takes to succeed. And, you know, with a mental illness too, like whatever you're struggling with is not insurmountable. I mean, I'm sure there's some things like, it's easy for me to say as a straight white guy living in America, you know, easy for me to say, but there's a whole lot that's really inspiring about, especially people like Adam Ant and people in the struggle, and then they push through and like, wow, okay, you know, I could push a little harder for myself, you know.
Thinking about the Michael Jackson ripoff. Do you guys know the story about how Darby Crash got a mohawk right before he died?
No.
He went to the UK and he hung out with, he was a huge Adam and the Ants fan. He went to the UK, found Adam, and hung out with him, spent most of the time that he was there, hanging out with him, came back with the mohawk and the face paint.
That makes sense.
Adam talked about this a few times in interviews around that time, and Darby talked about it too, that he was a huge fan of Adam Ant, and the mohawk was inspired by what he was doing. I think he went over, like, as Adam was working on Kings of the Wild Frontier, so it hadn't quite come out yet. It wasn't out. And so Darby went there and saw this, all the shit he was doing with the pirate garb and the Native American stuff, and was like, oh shit, I'm hopping on that train. Came back with a mohawk and face paint.
And giving everyone
germ
burns. Did you ever get germ burns?
No.
I know a couple people that did.
No, but my friend Tony Slug, who played drums in the band I was in, has a story about that, where he got the germ burn. Yeah. He said it was pretty fucked up. He said Darby was a fucking asshole and that he would do shit like that all the time.
Oh yeah.
What was I going to say? Oh, and then the other thing that happened. So when he came out here, when he came to LA for the first time to play do the Kings of the Wild Frontier thing, there was a big K-Rock event. There was some big K-Rock event that happened where there was like a big Adam and the Ants meet and greet, like, I don't know, they did a tower or something like that. And, they had some, they were driving some K-Rock van, like with Adam and the Ants garb all over it. I can't remember the exact story, but something happened. A bunch of punks showed up. And a bunch of graffitied like Black Flag stuff all over. And there was like this sort of like brief, like Adam and the Ants versus Black Flag feud kind of happening when he first came here. That was kind of funny. He was a polarizing guy at the time. There were punks that liked him. You know, just being a kid at the time, like being involved in the Orange County and LA scene, he was a very polarizing guy. There were people that liked him. There were people that hated him in amongst the punks. And that kind of came to a head with this first big like promotional event that he did for Kings of the Wild Frontier.
Well, I think one of the things that happens is when you take a extreme and unique position, you're going to attract a lot of attention, and some of it is going to be positive. If you commit, there will be people who appreciate what you're doing, but there's going to be plenty of it that's negative. And I think particularly on the punk side, people saw him as betraying the movement, you know, or stealing their ideas and
exactly.
Selling out or something, where it's like, well, he's not a real punk. He's just trying to leverage that. It's like, no, he started off pretty legit that way. Just wasn't interested in it because he saw it as the dead end that it was, you know. I keep coming back to this idea that, like, you know, having a vision and embracing it is really important as an artist. I think when we touched on this idea of the whole characters and look thing, and one real challenge is if you start investing a lot of energy into that, you do end up getting to a place of like, oh my God, who am I going to be next? What am I going to do next? And it takes away from the music and the general artistry of yourself. Those characters, the garb, whatever, it has to be some kind of reflection or something that has a connection to who you are. Otherwise, it just turns into, you know, you wearing a costume. And I think this is something that for the most part, Bowie was able to do, of basically presenting these characters as different facets of himself. You know, Adam Ant had a way of, he had a particularly strong image early on that was really defining. And I think in some ways he kind of had a hard time really moving past that. You know, here he is now and he is in his late 60s, I believe. And he is still claiming aspects of that very first look for himself. He still wears the kind of a colonial military jacket and the Napoleon hat and things like that. Which is fine. You know, it is a part. He is Stuart Goddard. He is Adam Ant. He is both of those things.
He wears it well.
Yeah. It's an interesting contrast, isn't it? He, unlike, what happened with Bowie and the Ziggy Stardust character, Bowie had the foresight to know to kill that character probably before he even bootstrapped it. I mean, he knew that was going to have a limited shelf life. Conversely, Adam Ant found himself in a similar position, had blew up with this character and this brand, this look, and never, you know, despite attempts to move it away from it with the album you guys were talking about with Desperate and Not Serious, you know, trying to move away from it in the late 80s, early 90s, he never really quite got out from under that. He couldn't make the transition to another character the way Bowie did.
Well, because ultimately he was the character, right? It was a look or a costume for him, and it worked really well. But like I said, people get tired of it, and you know, he made some steps forward on Strip, and then, you know, Viva La Rock and things like that. But I think the other issue is just he had been so big for so long, and people were sick of it, and tastes were changing. He also was a very idiosyncratic guy who liked making pop songs a certain way, and tastes in pop music move and migrate. I one of the takeaways for me is that basically if you're lucky enough to get to have some success as an artist, you have to recognize that a lot of it is out of your control. Like, you can make the best things that you can think of to make, but it's all about how that overlaps with what the public happens to want. And the public generally doesn't like things to change too much until suddenly they do. And that can be somewhat unpredictable. You know, you don't want to be 10% more than 10% weirder or different than whatever is popular until there's this kind of phase shift. And all of a sudden people are like, yeah, we don't like distorted guitars anymore. We want 808s, or we don't like 808s anymore. We want acoustic guitars, or we don't want acoustic guitars anymore. We want, synthesizers or whatever it is. You know, it's just how it goes. And that said, having the kind of career that he had, he's had a pretty good life. I think in the grand scheme of things, he's probably more focused on trying to get healthy and get better than anything else. And he looks at music now as sort of a job or a thing that he does or part of who he is, rather than like, I got to get out of this place. And the only way out is getting in a van with two drummers and, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He really speaks to it as a very much like therapy, like getting out and making music and performing. And I don't know how having two drummers could be therapeutic, because one is enough. But we'll get into drummer jokes at another episode.
Well, the two drummer thing was very definitely a nod to Gary Glitter and the Glitter Band.
I'm just talking about personalities.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Drummer personalities. No, the drummer thing, it was brilliant and it sounds amazing. And I got no issue with that. That was a very veiled, not so veiled drummer joke there. Sorry, D. I know you played.
That's okay. It's funny. I was on a team and, with my day job, my manager used to like to, tell drummer jokes at the end of every stand-up meeting. I thought it was really funny. As soon as he heard that I was a drummer.
Oh man, it's
he'd
great.
Start telling drummer jokes all the time. He'd find really, really, really horrible, awful ones to tell. It's funny.
And you know, the thing about we'll wrap up the drummer thing, but like the drummer thing is like, there is no music without really the rhythm and the drums, you know, the drums is really the core. And speaking of sort of like the roots of sort of music, you know, in the world from Africa, you know, the drums were critical. And then even, you know, maybe we should do an episode on the banjo too, because little known that that's an African instrument and all those Appalachians, you know, and then
it's very true.
You know, a lot of the people that were
banjo came from Africa, and the slide guitar came from Hawaii. They got that from the Hawaiians,
and we just stole it from them.
Yep,
both of them.
Well, it goes back to this, what we're talking about at the top of the show about the Burundi beat being the thing that kicks it off. Drums are really important for pop music in particular. I was thinking about this earlier this week. Like, you can get by with a lot of unskilled people in your band, particularly if you're just getting started or you're doing kind of punky stuff or indie stuff or whatever, but you need a good drummer. Like, that is the one thing that is irreplaceable. And that good drummer could be a robot. You know, if you want to use a machine or something like that, that's fine. But if you don't have a good drummer, I don't care how everybody else is in the band sucks.
It's a lot like sports that way. In hockey, you're arguably only as good as your goalie.
Yeah.
Watching the Padres game, by the way, go Padres. Padres just beat the Dodgers in the series. They're going to the next level.
Ooh.
Go Padres. Padres go are killing Padres. It. I hear the sports announcers talk about this a lot. Watching Padres games, you're really only as good as your pitcher.
Yeah,
if you don't have a good pool of pitchers, then you're not going to be a very good team. And it's the same. I agree with you, Anu. It's same holds true for drummers. You're really only as good as your drummer. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, it's primal. I mean, it's like the heartbeat. I mean, without the heartbeat, there is no life. So it's really like it runs through us. There is a pulse and a sort of a rhythm to everything. I mean, that's why I think it's so important to sort of get back to nature and sort of be in nature states for longer periods of time to sort of get, you know, attune your body. And this is really kind of, okay, a nod to the mindfulness, which is like, can you be in your skin and sort of like be with your heartbeat, be with the blood beating, all the shit that you have nothing to do with other than like, you know, don't impede it and don't kill yourself. You know, if it's just happening all the time and like the heartbeat, it's like the drums, you know, I totally agree. Every band that I've been in that's had like great drummers has just been a world of difference from like, you know, a pretty good drummer or like, yeah, he's all right. But it's always like in my head, I've got this sort of perfectionism about certain things. And it's like, we need a new drummer. You know, like there was one thing I was in for a while and, you know, everyone's kind of scratching their head and like, yeah, it's okay. And I'm like, the drummer's terrible. I like the guy a lot, but he's just not a fit for this. And like, and he was the friend of the singer. And I'm just like, oh, okay, I see where this is going. Much like Pistol, you know, it's like, I just need a mate in the band. And I'm just like, you need a great drummer. You know, most of the drummers I had played with, you know, they're kind of crunchy and they were amazing. And like, they hit shit for a living. They're really good at it. And so it's like, what kind of mentality? And some of them are just extraordinary. Like some of my favorite drummers are just like beyond. There was one thing I wanted to get back to as well, you know, sort of the kickback from the punk community. I mean, they had that same thing about the Police. The Police, they sort of claimed to come from sort of punk sensibilities and like they played fast music. That first record is extraordinary and sounds punk-like in terms of tempo, but like they were a whole other beast, you know, and like Andy Summers was arguably like one of the, you know, most popular guitar players along with like Jeff Beck and a couple other people little known to me until later in England. And so, and then there's Stuart Copeland. That's just like a beast of a drummer, just amazing and beyond. And they stole stuff from like, you know, sort of a lot of the Jamaican music and like island music and sort of the beats of like ska and reggae and like mm-hmm. what came into that. And, you know, that was another thing. And that shot through the roof too. Again, another sort of MTV without MTV, that band, you know, it was arguable how popular they would have been. And completely burned out and destroyed by 1984.
Well, I think in that case, first of all, one of the reasons is Stuart Copeland was familiar with all of that stuff, all these beats, is that he grew up all around the world because his father was heavily involved with United States.
Wasn't he like an American diplomat or something like that?
He was heavily involved with the intelligence agencies.
That's what it was.
Being a diplomat was his cover. And
hence the label name IRS.
Associations with the government, which is why Stuart Copeland and his brother, all of their business ventures are called things like FBI, IRS, et cetera. I think that you are partially correct in that without a doubt, one of the reasons the police were successful is that they were good looking. But their videos are pretty much up until Synchronicity, their videos are all pretty lame and did not get a ton of airplay. And so I'm not totally sure that I would ascribe a lot of their success, maybe the Synchronicity record, but I think the thing that for the police for me is like, they were very clear up front. They're like, we're not a punk band. People are lumping us in there because we play kind of fast and we're not prog rock or whatever. I think they always saw themselves as kind of a pop band, but they had great songs. They had great songs from day one. And they incorporated a little bit of reggae and stuff because everybody in the UK was doing it. I think they did it with a little more facility than some people because everybody in that band was a top shelf musician.
Well, that country has such a rich, rich Jamaican history too. They were, you know, all those guys grew up with that stuff and they had Don Letts like playing that shit before punk rock shows all the time.
Yeah. So they were in it and they wrote great songs. And I think ultimately the thing that made them successful was the fact that they wrote these amazing songs Sting wrote most of the big hits, but that's what really blew them up. And this is the other thing to, you know, go back to Adam Ant here. It's like, it's easy to focus on things like the face paint, the jacket, the beat, the drums, but what it really comes down to for me ultimately is like the guy knows how to write some great songs. Some of them are a little weird, just weird enough to catch your ear and be memorable.
And Marco Peroni is, he's just hook master. He's the master hooks fell out of him like diarrhea.
Very, very clever guitar player. And it worked very well with
so
Adam
prolific Ant. That guy.
Yeah, and I love Adam Ant's like vocal hooks and the way he is so able to write these songs that have just tons of little memorable bits, even if it's not words. It might just be him moaning or yelping or grunting. But, you know, he's one of those artists. Like, you can show me 10 of his song titles, I probably can sing you the chorus or a hook or a line of it or whatever. And it's not just because of familiarity. It's because that stuff sticks in your freaking
head.
Shit's
fucking catchy.
Yeah.
It's catchy.
Yeah. And all of the rest of it, the outfits and everything else, is just amplification for that. So it comes down to, you know, can you write some good songs and then do the right kind of thing to get people to pay the right kind of attention to what you're doing? If he hadn't had the songs, he wouldn't have made it. And he wasn't, you know, in the United States, again, people tend to think of him as like, oh, he's that one hit wonder guy that had Goody Two Shoes. But it's like, that's really not an accurate representation of him at all.
No, tons, it's not.
Tons it's of not. Hits, especially in the UK. But over here, I mean, every song that I listened to over the last couple of days, I just kind of did like a binge on Adam Ant stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's right, that one too. And then I'm singing along with every single one of them. Because like, if you hear it once or twice, it just is so sticky. And it's like, damn, that is great songwriting. I mean, you know, quirky, definitely signature. Like every time you hear it, it's like, I can't say it sounds like anybody else, really. I mean, there was a few British artists that were like picked a few things from him, you know, or maybe he picked from them, but I'm just like, he was his own thing. And I think that was what we were talking about as a character. He put it all together, he owned it in a way and brought his own sort of personal flavor to it that really, you know, sort of breathed life into it and gave it its own humanity. You know,
he doesn't have a good voice, right? Like if you think about his singing voice, it is not the sort of thing where you're like, wow, that's really beautiful. Or I'm so emotionally moved by it, right? His voice is really idiosyncratic. I think Dee, you were saying earlier, he's kind of yelping and, you know, wailing, and he gets kind of thin up in the upper register and so forth. And there aren't really any of his songs that I'm like, oh, you know, this is such intense feeling, unless just sheer horniness is a feeling.
Yeah.
But he's a pop singer, right? It's like, you will sing along, you will get up and want to move around. It is not the sort of thing that you're going to be reading the lyrics at anybody's funeral or wedding, hopefully. But still a master, and someone who is, more than anything else, someone who managed to keep music fun at a time when a lot of people were trying to make it really, really, really serious.
That's important. That's an important thing to bring up. It is very much something that was happening at the time, you know. Hardcore, Kings of the Wild Frontier came out in 1980. That's hardcore was at its peak in LA in SF. Like, you know, those were salad days of punk rock. And he came out with this thing that was so not that.
It was danceable and quirky and fun, but because, you know, punk had a really dark edge.
This is not dark political music.
Yeah,
and I also have to wonder if all that twangy guitar stuff that Marco was doing, between the sort of look of things and everything else, I have to feel that this kind of style that these guys were putting out there had to get picked up by some of the cowpunks in LA. Maybe the Gun Club even. I can't point to any, you know, specific stuff, but it seems to me like there are some people who must have looked at some of that early Adam Ant stuff and been like,
oh, a lot of people
do this, but like, you know,
a lot of people were. Yeah. A lot of people were borrowing that sort of rock and roll Burundi beat for things quite a bit. To varying degrees, for sure.
Well, and definitely
British bands too.
Yeah, the guitar playing too. I mean, that very much like Ennio Morricone sort of bringing this stuff from like the 60s and 70s sort of through there, where it was like these iconic sounding things. And that's really what struck me too in listening to this stuff over and over again is the layers of guitars and all the sort of different colors that were there.
I don't even think I knew who Ennio Morricone was before Kings of the Wild Frontier blew up, and just listen to those guys talk about how big of an influence, I was aware of Spaghetti Western music, but that album was the first thing where I was educated on who he was and what that music was, you know?
Yeah. And what it all meant. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we're always trying to like sort of beg, borrow and steal from the right people at the right time. And like, hopefully no one else is doing this right now. Or like, I'm going to put a little bit in here, but not too much where you're like, oh, you're an Ennio, you know, Morricone fan. Like, okay, that's nice. And then they move on. It's like, can I keep the pop song intact or whatever it is that is your signature, that you're hoping is your signature, and then bring some different kind of life to it? And his guitar playing, like you said, Anu, was just like, what is this? I mean, it's just as a guitar player, I could just listen to the guitar alone and just ignore the song and just be like, wow, just really. And also his work with the producer, Chris, you know, the producer really like brought all those elements in, as hopefully a great producer will do, like, but not only the drums, but the guitar work. And then the sort of like signature quirky vocals and the harmonic structure was really great. Cause there was some sort of slightly dark, they would dip into a dip sort of transition and then back into the pop again. And I'm like, wow. You know, it keeps it fresh and it tickles the brain into paying attention to shit, because people get, you know, bored. The brain gets bored. I mean, I have it with mastering, you know, and mixing. It's like if something doesn't change every sort of like four bars, you know, the brain goes like, okay, I know what's next. And they turn it off. They don't know why, but they change the station, you know. So it really is important. And all those elements that added up to this Adam Ant career and continues. I haven't heard the new stuff. I'm curious to go sort of like pillage that and sort of listen to it and see, but I hope he's doing more of that signature.
That album that he did around the time you saw him play live, Michael, I was listening to that quite a bit when it came out. It's good. It's pretty good.
I heard it was great. I hadn't heard it myself. And it's good. You know, I didn't miss it. I just went to the show and I heard the new stuff and the old stuff. And I'm just like, and everyone went nuts. I mean, that's kind of the point, is everyone just like up out of their seats, entertained and dancing and having a great time. And I think, man, it's hard to get people to pay attention to you, let alone like, can you make them pop out of their seat and go, oh shit. Like, they don't know why they're doing it, but they're like at the stage going like, oh yes. You know, because everyone else is doing it and you're digging what's coming through your ears. I mean,
well, part of the value of an entertainer like Adam Ant is he is basically saying, look, I'm free. I'm uninhibited. I'm expressing my joy. You can too. And that in some ways.
And you don't have to be nihilistic to do it.
Yeah.
I think that was an important aspect of Adam, especially when he did the Kings of the Wild Frontier thing, is it was like a way of saying, he was just another one of those people, those magical people that said, you can do this another way. You don't have to scream about nervous breakdowns. You can do this another way.
Yeah. Being happy or being carefree is way scarier than being dark and angry and sad.
Way more. Yes.
Yeah. Especially these days. It's easy to be cynical. I mean, I can speak for myself, but you know, cynicism comes up and I'm like, oh, that's nice. And I hear this voice and I'm just like, oh, that's shitty. You know, and it's like, that's my own voice. And I can kind of like set it aside and come back and go, you know, can I just listen with a fresh ear, you know, especially listening to music and being in the business for so long, it's easy to get cynical on like what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong. But like when something just kind of completely takes over, like an Adam, you put an Adam in the Ant song on and I'm just like, oh, this is great. Like, I don't know. I just kind of jump into a whole other happy mode and all your problems kind of disappear for like 3 minutes, you know?
And when I think about, you know, songs that kind of capture that ethos, the one of his songs that's always stood out to me is sort of him being like, okay, I'm going to tell you what this is all about. Come here, I'll tell you. Is Prince Charming, where, you know, the lyrics are like, don't you ever stop being dandy, showing me you're handsome. Ridicule is nothing to be scared of. Don't you ever lower yourself, forgetting all your standards. Silk or leather or a feather, respect yourself and all of those around you. And it's like, that feels very contemporary in terms of sending out a message of support and inclusivity. And that is from, you know, way, way back. You know, that song, very simple. He repeats the words over and over again. And I think that was sort of like his credo, or the message. If he had a message, that's what he wanted to get out there. It's like, be yourself. Don't be ashamed of it. Respect yourself.
And he was all about positivity too. Like, he would talk about this a lot in interviews. Like, he just like, he hated that punk veered into this nihilistic kind of direction. And he was working very, very hard to rail against that. And he was really, he was a super positive guy. He was all about, like, you know, like you said, Anu, just express yourself and you know, you don't have to be nihilistic in the process of doing it.
Yeah. And I think that's super rare. I think it's super rare these days, you know, that we can feign positivity, and there's some people that, I don't know, maybe it's my cynicism talking, but when it's really genuine, like his interviews were really great to listen to. And I'm just like, I really like this guy. He's the real deal as a human being, but also as an artist. And I'm just like, and this isn't a business to get into if you're looking for stability. This is, you know, there's a lot of easier ways to make money and take care of yourself, but because it is a roller coaster, no matter what sort of path you choose. And it could be straight to the top, but like, the fall is pretty steep, you know? So if you're willing to roll with that stuff, and there's kind of a sickness about it, because like, I'm compelled to do it. I cannot not do this. I questioned myself about 5 or 6 years ago. I'm like, is this still for me? Like, what am I doing? And the answer was just a resounding, oh yeah, this is part of you. It's a sickness and a blessing all at the same time. And like, we do it because we love it. And that sort of discovery, you know, and for some people, like, obviously he wanted to be a superstar at a certain point, but it didn't start that way. You know, he was just wanted to be a part of it in the punk scene. And then he was just like, oh, there's so much more I want, which is great. I mean, what a great path to take for your own discovery, and not to be all, you know, woo-woo about it. But
even when you go back, like if you go back and watch Jubilee, or you listen to any of the really early stuff, even then he was kind of on his own path. You know, he really was not doing what the Sex Pistols were doing, or the Clash, or the Buzzcocks. Like he was doing his own thing from the get-go, you know? He was doing punk rock his own way. And when he started doing the Burundi Beat thing, he did that his own way.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways that idea of let's not do the obvious thing, or let's not do what everybody else is doing, is one of the things that's really defining about him. I mean, you can look at things like the Clash and the Sex Pistols and basically say, okay, well, you know, it's some distorted guitars and it's got the, what we think of today as like the roots of punk music, of like, it's fast and it's loud and not a lot of subtlety, and, you know, it's bar chords and maybe some other things and a little of this and a little of that, but you kind of know the space it's in. And even as I think back to the early Adam and the Ants stuff that was a little bit punkier, there isn't really much of that. I mean,
no.
If
there's like some $5 chords in Xerox, if you listen to Xerox, there's like some sustained chords in there and shit. He's like, he's got shit going on that no one else was doing.
I was just like thinking of the intro to that song too, D, like the crazy little any other band that was doing that song would have just been going dun 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 dun, you know?
And yes.
Every single one of his songs, I think that's a part of it. It's like whatever is the obvious thing, let's not do that. And I think that's part of what made him successful and then perhaps made him unsuccessful later. He was aware that he wasn't going to stay on top forever, and he got a little bit bitter about it. And you can hear some of that in some of his lyrics here and there. He's got a song called "Here Comes the Grump," which is basically about how, you know,
I saw that quote.
I sent some of the lyrics to D in the prep for this, and I always thought that was great. This was on his most successful record, and it was basically saying, "I know they're coming for me. They're going to come and take me down." You know, when you've got a number one, the only way is down.
It's just the way that scene was in the UK at the time. I mean, you know, it's a very small country. It's a very small audience consuming that stuff. And it was not uncommon for a band to appear on Top of the Pops, have a number one hit for 2 weeks and then disappear. Like that's the world he lived in. That was his reality.
Get successful, and then the music press decides, okay, time to send you to hell. I mean,
yeah.
And the entire
if you didn't wither away into obscurity, then NME, then the Nick Kents of the world, we're gonna fucking shut you down anyway, because that's just the way that the press was. That if they decided you were no longer relevant, you were no longer relevant.
Yeah,
he talks about it in Goody Two Shoes. He talks about that in Goody Two Shoes. He talks about that's what that whole song's about. It's like, I'm not fucking done, Nick Kent. Fuck off. That's kind of what he's saying.
Well, quite the character. I'm glad we're talking about him today. I'm glad I did my research too. It was really fascinating. I'm still, you know, I'm going to dig deeper into the production work too. I mean, it was great. There was a great article in the article with his producer was in Forbes magazine of all things, you know? And
wow,
you know, the Tears for Fears thing that happened like closely after that, and just like, you know, his sort of shaping of his little piece of, you know, English music history at that time in the 80s, and like how enormous that was, especially the Tears for Fears stuff, which was like, still, you know, you hear that song and you're like, wow, okay, signature production, beautiful performances, and you know that he brought that to you know, this quirky Adam Ant and the beats, and like, and then he also played in the band. He was enthusiastic enough to be like, oh yeah, I know exactly what to do with this. And I'm in.
Yeah. You know, well, I think the success of Adam and the Ants actually helped his career get off the ground more than anything else. Like, I don't think it was like, oh, I'm a famous producer and I will play with Adam and the Ants. Oh, he started off, you know, as the drummer for Adam and the Ants and produced a couple of songs that did real well. And one, the Kings of the Wild Frontier had three hits on it, and he got named producer of the year by Music Week. And I think that was the thing that kicked off his career. I'm looking at his credits list, and it's like, it's friggin' solid gold, amazing stuff. The guy clearly had chops. He's like, aside from Adam and the Ants and Tears for Fears, it's like Robert Plant, Paul McCartney, Peter Gabriel.
Holy shit. He's a player.
Rick Ocasek, Wang Chung, Propaganda, Howard Jones, Lloyd Cole, John Bon Jovi, Tori Amos, Enya.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah, and he didn't walk into it with that. I mean, that's what I really love is, you know, you take what you got in the moment and you just make it great. And he had, you know, like anyone with any sort of production vision, you're like, oh, I know what I would do with that. You know, that's why it's so fun to work with other people. You know, I'm looking forward to my next project where we can dig into more of that, you know, that sort of reactive chemistry and all that, which I miss from being in a band because it was so immediate and like sometimes, you know, tumultuous, but also, you know, very rich in terms of creative depth. So, and he had that, you know, before. I think you're right, Anu. I think he probably, that probably gave him entree to a whole lot of stuff where they're like, well, not only the record labels where they're like, oh, look at what this kid just did with this weirdo, you know, Indian pirate kid, you know, it's like, what do you do with that? And so they like, if it can make him great, it can make anyone great. So he really, I'm sure it sounds like he capitalized on it really well, but interesting, nice character too. And he talked about how Adam and Peroni would write together too. And their sense of humor was really dark and funny, but like not so much like a wink, but like they were real. And they just included it in their production and in terms of their writing. And I'm like,
cheeky. They were cheeky.
Definitely. So it was cool to read that. But the production for sure. I mean, if you want like a, you know, a class in production, I'd love to take that guy's class. That would be amazing. Like, wow. It's just thinking outside of the box. And like when you say Burundi beat, and he was like, oh yeah, I know what to do. And he just, and if he didn't, he certainly made it work in a way that was like, you know, way better than what the punk stuff he was doing before.
He really did know what to do. And yeah. And that's the thing too, that when you listen to that stuff next to the Bow Wow Wow stuff, like what he was doing with that beat was quite a bit different. Was heavy. Yeah. It was heavier in a way, you know, like if Bow Wow Wow was doing Fela Kuti, Adam and the Ants were doing Metallica, AC/DC. I don't know.
Enter Sandman by Adam and the Ants.
Enter Sandman. he had a little bit of metal flavor to some of the stuff. You know, Ant Invasion's a pretty sludgy slab of metal, really. And what Trent did with Physical is a testament to that too. It's Physical also pretty metally, kind of sludgy metal. Like it seemed like Marco had a proclivity for that. Like he played like a guy that probably had some AC/DC in his record rack.
Well, I don't know if there's a rock musician out there who doesn't have some of that in their head somewhere.
Yeah.
Bring in the darkness. Well, that was delightful. What do we take away from Mr. Adam Ant?
Commit to the bit. Right? Mm-hmm. That's number
one. I like that. I'm going to keep that.
Be yourself as hard as you can. Don't do what everybody else is doing. And I guess the fourth and perhaps more serious thing is like, take care of your mental and physical health. Everybody's got problems. You know, he was able to recognize after some real near misses that he had serious problems and went and got professional help and is doing fine now, as fine as anyone with his condition can do. So think about that as well. It's another one. For me, it touches on another one of these, like, you don't, It is a dangerous and toxic myth that you have to be mentally ill or damaged to be an artist. But it is not surprising that many people who become artists have some of that in their background because they're not real good at communicating or dealing with the world in other ways.
Yeah,
so those would be true. My things.
It's a nice start, but it's also a swift end if you're not taking care of yourself. You know what I mean? So, yeah. I think it's great to be able to talk about that too. He's really like a great message carrier for that world. He talked a little bit about when he sort of discovered what was going on. Cause he contracted something that caused depression. It was a chemical thing. He was in Mexico and drank some water that was bad, and it caused this depression, this like chemistry change in him.
Oh shit.
Probably activated. And he was having some of these issues before, but he said, that sent him down a spiral. And so once they sort of got that under control, then it became apparent like the other symptoms really, you know, and who knows if that accelerated it, but he was pretty candid about that. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing that they could distinguish all that. Like how lucky is he that he didn't end up, you know, at the end of a rope or, you know, with a belly full of pills and some booze. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you watch that Madness of Prince Charming thing, he was definitely very vocal about mental health and mental health issues at a time, no doubt that no one else really was.
Yeah. And I think that's a testament kind of that signature, like who he is as a human being kind of transcends the music part of it. I mean, he brings it shows up in the music as a very compelling artist, but also like as a human being and listening to some of the interviews and reading some of those interviews, I'm just like, this guy is a stellar human being. And it's like, he picks that up, that stuff up and carries it with him too. And even just addressing sort of like the cultural appropriation, you know, I think he just hit that shit head on. And I'm like, I got respect for that. Cause a lot of people, I mean, even these days they're like, yeah, it was wrong. I'm sorry. You know, I won't do it again, but they don't really like deal with it. And so that was really helpful to see. As a human being, I just have a lot more respect, you know, so it was cool to kind of do this dive on the guy.
Pretty yeah. Cool. Yeah.
So take notes, kids. Face your shit head on.
Take notes. And I mean, the other big lesson, just thinking about Anu is commit to the bit.
Yeah.
That's going to be my new mantra. You know, the whole Kings of the Wild Frontier thing is a testament to just trusting your voice. That when you look at what he did on paper, it's so fucking incongruous. You know, like I can't imagine anybody, no matter how talented they are, sitting in a room and going, okay, I like the glitter band. I like the two drummer thing. I like the heavy guitars. And I'm really into the pirate garb. I think we should all wear pirate garb, put Indian face paint on, and sing about ants. Like that, it makes no fucking sense. It makes no sense, but he sells it. He makes it work because it makes perfect sense to him.
What?
And when you hear him talk about it at the time, like if you go back and read interviews with him at the time, he could talk your fucking ear off about that shit.
Yeah.
It made perfect sense to him.
Well studied and like thought about and like thorough through all of it. And then, you know, he integrated it all. I think that's really like a sign of a real sort of visionary spirit that comes through, which is, I don't know if it's available to all of us. I think it is if you're willing to sort of commit to the bit, as Anu said, you know, it's like, you may fall on your fucking face, but at least you tried it, you know, like he tried it. And, you know, like you said, D, it's like on paper, I'd be like, I don't know if you like gave me the concept of it. I'm like, I'm interested to see it because like, I like sort of the more extreme stuff, but as a record label, I'd be like, I don't know.
Oh, never mind that. I guarantee you that in 1991, if I walked into the room and said, okay, Chris, Jason, Andy, this is what we're going to do, they'd say, fuck you. No fucking way.
Yeah.
Shut up. Shut up. Go get yourself another beer and let's start practicing.
Yeah. Are you
okay? Like it wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen. You know?
Are you okay?
That's the thing that's interesting too, is that he managed to fucking, he didn't just manage to sell it to the public. He managed to sell the idea to, and got people behind it, you know?
Yeah. You got to get buy-in. I mean, you know, that's the,
you do.
The radical thoughts. Like it's about agreement. If you can get enough agreement, because there's enough stuff out there where I'm like, that should have never happened. But if you get enough agreement and buy-in on these things, and enough people follow you, it's like, oh, I mean, that's how great stuff happens, and that's how horrible stuff happens.
It's true.
Politics, yes. Like World War II, and like, you know, schmoes like that getting out there, because like they sold it, you know, great orators, great like inspirational people for the good of the people and for the bad of the people. So do good, people. Get your vision out there. As long as it ain't, you know, hurting other people, I say live and let live, and you know, fly your freak flag and give it a shot.
But again, it's a testament to trusting your own voice and being mindful, being open to allowing your mind to be open to things that your mind might be telling you could work. You know what I mean? Like
unusual.
You guys know what I'm saying. Like when we all kind of scratch down ideas and stuff, and we look at them and go, well, that could work. No, that might not work. It's a testament to being being open and being mindful, and just being open to any possibility. And if it's speaking to you, then just fucking do it. Just do it.
Yeah. If you're risk averse, it's a scary proposition. But like, I mean, that's that line between sort of fear and excitement is really blurred in my family, and especially in me. So I'm willing to take more chances and trying stuff.
Same.
It's just like in a room with some guitars and stuff, and you try some and you're like, oh, I think this could be amazing. And you hear it and you're like, oh, it's awful. And then you erase it and you try something new. But I think if people are always trying something new, more doors open. I mean, from the last episode that's just getting posted, you know, like the choices that we made in the past and the stuff where we didn't take the risk. It's like you can take some healthy risks, and I think that's important for me to do, and so I encourage other people to do it too.
Like in the words of the master, ridicule is nothing to be scared of.
Yes!
There we go. And with that, we're complete.
Don't you ever lower yourself, forgetting all your standards.
Yeah. I kind of like the embarrassment, the experience of embarrassment sometimes. I think that's why I'm well suited for the music industry and entertainment in general, because like there's some sick part of me that just loves that piece of it. I don't seek it out, but I'm willing to bear it if it happens. And I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah, some people pay big money for that.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Big money. Well, I guess Kanye is finding that out right now. But let's not talk about Kanye today. Maybe another episode.
We don't need to ever really talk about Kanye.
Yeah, we'll leave him there.
He can. Kanye's got plenty of people to talk about him. That he doesn't need us.
But right, you can talk about music, mindfulness, and madness if you go to our website.
Yes.
An Instacart link. If you everything's delivered within how many minutes? 2 minutes? No, like 30 minutes.
In as fast as an hour.
Yes.
Okay. That's even better. As many burritos as you can think of.
Go get your frozen burritos at Instacart. MusicMindfulMadness.com/Instacart. Sign up. Help us out.
Go to Instagram. Go to Facebook. We have pages on all that. Send us some messages. Let us know you're alive. Send us pictures.
Send us some messages.
If you see us out in public, send us pictures. Sightings. The Yeti.
We've been streaming live on YouTube and Twitch. Seems like we're actually getting people to watch us on Facebook based on what I see happening.
My girlfriend saw us on Facebook and I was horrified because I didn't know we were live on there. And I'm was my camera off? Was it on? So I keep it from the waist up.
Michael, I told you.
Yeah, I probably blocked it out. That's my own embarrassment. That's part of my own sickness. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. We have my friend Sarah from JPL/NASA. She's committed to a date. And right. So the gentleman here, we will speak about it later and figure out what to talk about. She's very excited about it. She's a super interesting human being and super genius. And yeah, that's coming up. And send us messages. Send us burritos from Instacart. And
send us burritos. We could always use a burrito.
And thanks for being curious and showing up for the show. And we'll talk to you all next week.
But before we do that, it's that time.
That's right.
You guys got a card?
Yes.
Okay, you ready? Michael, I still can't see you, so you're going to have to read yours.
Okay.
Unless you can see him on it. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Boom. Boop. Anu's got trust in the you of now. Oh, that's a good one for this episode. What do you got, Michael?
I'm going to have to pull it down. Read it backwards. Short circuit. Example, a man eating peas with the idea that they will improve his virility shovels them straight into his lap.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah.
Short circuit. Go straight to it.
I pulled that one before. Mine is only one element of each kind, which definitely runs in stark contrast with the artist we're talking about. That's that.
Take your wisdom home. Whatever you need to do with that. Wrap it in a beautiful spiritual tortilla and eat it.
Yes.
And yes. We'll see y'all next week. There's a couple new episodes that are going to be up in the next few days. So go check those out. And this episode will be up later this week.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as
I can. And you can always come back and watch it here. You can watch it on the Facebooks, on our Facebooks page. Can also watch it on the YouTubes and on Twitch, twitch.tv/musicmindfulness. That I can't talk on it. twitch.tv/musicmindfulnessmadness.
And as I tell my clients, don't worry, it's only permanent forever on the internet.
Flavor vision ain't blurry.
Someday this is going to come back and bless us. Blessings. All right, you guys, have a great week, and I'll talk to you all later.
All right.